Well, good morning to all of you. It's a pleasure for my wife and I to have the privilege of being here today. We were in St. Louis quite a number of years ago at services. Actually, I think the services were held over in Belleville. And according to my records, it was April 30th, 1968. Probably some of you weren't there at that particular service, but I think it included not only the St. Louis Church, but also the Belleville Church at that particular time. I was thinking that we had been in St. Louis for service at another occasion, but I couldn't find any record of it. And since my memory is rather short, I couldn't be sure about it. But at least we have been in the area before, even though it's been quite some time ago. So most of you, I suppose that we are strangers, unless you might have seen us at Big Sandy at one of the feasts, or at the Dells, or at the Ozarks, or probably not Tucson. Some of you might have been to Tucson at one time or another. You might wonder why we are here. We have had the privilege over the last several months of visiting quite a number of the churches. This has been since August, and today we will be visiting the 29th and 30th churches in this particular part of the country. Mr. Armstrong has asked us to visit the churches in this particular area, but to continue to live in Pasadena. And so our normal routine is to leave on Thursday or Friday, go out to a church area, visit with the ministers, the elders, deacons, and wives, visit with the churches, speak at the churches, and then return on Sunday or Monday. Sometimes we've stayed out a longer period of time for a couple of weekends, but normally we're back in Pasadena during the middle part of the week. And most of the time we are in the Atlantic or the Eastern time zone, which is 3 hours difference, of course, from Pasadena. They say that when you cross these sort of imaginary time zones, that each hour you pass after you arrive, it takes you one day to sort of get back to normal. So we go for 3 days approximately, and so when we just get straightened around, then we go back to Pasadena, then it takes 3 days to get straightened out again. So usually on Wednesday, we're sort of straightened out. The rest of the week, we're sort of mixed up as when we should sleep and when we should eat and when we shouldn't do those things. Well, I make it sound maybe a little worse than it really is, but it is a factor, and it does keep us a little off our normal equilibrium. We have been visiting quite a bit of late in the Ohio area, and also 2 weeks ago we were in the Peoria and also the Macomb area. And God willing, next time we'll be in Columbus, Ohio, next Sabbath. And we'll be visiting in the Belleville, Mount Vernon area next month, about the middle of next month sometime, if the present schedule holds out anyway. So we have been visiting the churches, and that's why we're here. I hope that we'll be able to tell you a little bit about Pasadena and Mr. Armstrong and some of the things that are going on in the work in a more personal way than maybe just reading about it, even though you'll be reading about some of the things that I'll be talking about as well. We've just completed a couple very eventful weeks at Pasadena, and it started out, I guess, not quite 2 weeks ago on January 1st with the Rose Parade. I'm sure you're all familiar with the Rose Parade. It was on national television and normally is. And at that particular occasion, there are approximately 2 million people, at least some estimates say 2 million. Others say that that's exaggerated, but at least an awful lot of people. And a lot of them just right around the campus, because that's where this very famous Rose Parade starts, right adjoining the campus on Orange Grove Avenue. This gives the Southland, that's the Southland of California, churches opportunities to make a little income for their church activities. And so I think an awful lot of people from the various Los Angeles area churches spent the night working and the early part of the day, the first part of the day on the first, doing all kinds of work such as ushering for various bleachers where people sit to watch this Rose Parade, parking cars, the thousands, hundreds of thousands of cars, manning snack booths around the city, and doing various other things. And unless you've seen the Rose Parade in person, I'm sure you don't fully understand what it's like. What you see on television, of course, does not give you the full picture. Now, the first this year was on a Tuesday, and on Sunday, or earlier, I don't know, the first I noticed was on Sunday, we went out to look along the parade route, and people were already camped out waiting for the parade on Tuesday. Now, this was illegal. They weren't supposed to be there until the next day at noon, and so the police would come in and confiscate their belongings, whatever they had, and tell them to get off the parking strip or the sidewalk. And I understand that they had about three echelons of people, a lot of them did anyway. And so when the police would move one group off, then their buddies would come in and take possession of that little plot of ground. And then the police would come and get them and move them off, and then the third echelon would come. And then when it came time for the fourth go-around, well, then the first people came back so that they were able to stake out their particular little area and stay there night and day until the parade started. And that's how they and their friends, I guess, were able to get free seats, if you'd call it free, there right on the parade. It's an incredible sight, at least I've always thought it was. And when I saw some of our people there for the first time, I said, well, you never saw anything like this before, did you? And, of course, they said, no, you know, this is just crazy. So if you ever have a chance to be there for the Rose Parade, the real parade starts before that, the night before, or maybe two nights before that. And that's the most interesting part, I've always thought. So that was January 1st. Then a couple days later, on the 3rd, on Thursday, at the auditorium in Pasadena, we had the taping of the Bob Hope special. Probably you haven't heard much about that, but you may be reading about it or seeing it on television January 21st, because that's when it will be nationally viewed. I think it's on NBC. I don't know the hour. I guess that would vary from area to area, but you may want to see that on January 21st, because it was taped there at the auditorium in Pasadena. Bob Hope had with him as his guests B. Arthur, Shirley Jones, Debbie Boone, and Diane Carroll. It took about 3 hours, I think, to tape this particular show, which will be shown in just an hour's time. And all of it, of course, will not be shown, particularly parts of Mr. Hope's monologue, which I think took about 21 minutes. They'll cut that down to about 8 minutes. Then the next night, Friday night the 4th, during the Bible study period at Pasadena, we were shown for the first time the one-hour documentary about the invasion and takeover of the church by the Attorney General and his officers and so forth in California. And, of course, you've been hearing an awful lot about that over the past year. And this was practically on the anniversary of that particular takeover. Actually, I think it was just one day off from that. I think the original invasion was on the 3rd, and so this was on the 4th, Friday night. This is going to be shown starting in California, January the 15th, over Southern California Television. I can't remember which station. I think it's Channel 13. And then hopefully in due time it can be shown in many other areas around the United States, and then maybe by either cassette tape or by film in various churches around the world. This is a very interesting, engrossing, and very informative documentary of what has happened. Then the next day, which was just a week ago, on Sabbath, we were able to see at Pasadena Mr. Herbert Armstrong by microwave video hookup, and we're able to see him on the screen there in Pasadena, California, at the various places where people were gathered on campus. Now, this is a hookup to Tucson, to Mr. Armstrong's home, and Mr. Armstrong gave the sermon, which was, I think, about an hour, maybe just a little bit short of an hour. And I understand that the audio portion of that will be sent out to the various churches, so you may be able to hear it here in the local area as well. I might say that there were 5,200 people on campus that particular Sabbath, last Sabbath, and they were meeting in practically all of the auditoriums and assembly halls on campus. Of course, the main group being in the auditorium, but not the largest. Both college and high school gymnasium, I think there were about 1,400 in one of the gymnasiums, and also the student center, two large lecture halls in the class area, and also at the recital hall. So all told, there were 5,200 people there to see and to hear Mr. Armstrong by this microwave video hookup. At the same time, there was a telephone hookup to quite a number of churches around the United States and Canada. In fact, there were 22 different hookups like that, so that about 8,000 or 9,000 additional people were able to hear Mr. Armstrong live. So this means that between 13,000 and 14,000 people were able to hear Mr. Armstrong speaking live last Sabbath in various places around the world, around the United States and also Canada, as I mentioned. In Pittsburgh, I think they had, it seems to be, 7 churches gathered together in one location to hear Mr. Armstrong on this hookup. I don't know of any other places where they had a larger number of churches together. So that was last Sabbath, and then Sunday night, this past Sunday night, there was a church dance. This was sort of in, I was going to say in honor of, maybe that's not the right term. In memory of, maybe that's nearer the term, but anyway, the takeover of the state just practically 1 year previous to that. But anyway, a church dance at the famous Hollywood Palladium. Probably you have seen maybe various programs from the Hollywood Palladium. That was quite famous back in World War II, as I recall, and a lot of the famous bands played there back during that time, and I guess even still there are some famous bands that play there. But we had people from the Southern California churches, as far away, at least from my personal knowledge, from the Bay Area, Fresno, Tucson, Phoenix, and where else I don't know, but we had over 3,000, I think it was over 3,200 people at that particular occasion. And it was a very happy occasion. People seemed to really be enjoying it. And in all of these activities that I've just mentioned, at least those involving the church, the people seemed very, very happy, and it seemed like, as some said, like old times, because there was certainly, obviously, a great deal of love and affection and joy that was expressed in these various occasions. That was last Sunday night. Then Thursday, this past Thursday, day before yesterday, I had the opportunity and privilege of visiting, along with several others, with Mr. Armstrong in Tucson. I might mention that the previous day, Wednesday, he had received a large group of ministers, well, large, I think, is 11, sabbatical ministers who have completed their sabbatical program now, who will be going out to field assignments. And so he visited with them for 2 or 3 hours on Wednesday afternoon, along with some other ministers who were there for other matters, to talk to Mr. Armstrong. Then, this coming week, there will be another group of sabbatical ministers, so I think that all 20, more or less, however many there are, the sabbatical ministers will have an opportunity to visit with Mr. Armstrong before they go out to the field. Well, on Thursday, there were 5 evangelists there, plus the managing editor of the Plain Truth, Good News, and Worldwide News, plus the dean of students, and various others. And we were there for, among other things, a very special occasion, the ordaining of another evangelist. I think this makes number 19 of the evangelists that we have in the church. And I'm sure that many of you know of this particular man, and I would think you'd be very pleased to hear that Mr. Harold L. Jackson, our first Negro evangelist. And it was very exciting and very pleasurable for us to have a part and to be able to be there for that particular ordination. Mrs. Jackson was also with Mr. Jackson, and now Mr. Jackson's duties may be changed somewhat. I think he may be visiting the churches in certain parts of the United States and also abroad, traveling maybe a little bit more than he has been in the past. He has been working in Africa, in Black Africa, and I think they are presently or have been living in Kenya. But probably that will be modified or changed somewhat. And I'm sure that all of you old-timers know Mr. Jackson. Maybe he's a stranger to some of you. There also, at the same time, Mr. Armstrong ordained a man who had been a preaching elder for quite a number of years as a pastor. This particular man has been in the church for many years. I don't remember exactly when he first came in the church, but it was, I think, in the early 50s, if I recall correctly. And he spent quite a bit of time in your area here. And so I think that many of you will be pleased to know that Mr. Frank McCready, Jr. is now a pastor, a ranked minister in the Church of God. He had his wife with him also, his new wife, who comes from this general area. And then yesterday flew back to New York. Mr. Armstrong commented at some length about the world situation, and he believes now that things on the world scene are going to begin to move very fast. And he thinks that time is not going to be delayed any longer, that things are going to, you know, really start to move on the world scene. Mr. Armstrong discussed with Mr. Raymond McNair, who was there, various things relating to the college, the 1980 Envoy, new classes that are going to be added at the college in Pasadena, and various other matters. Now, they have been working for some weeks now, actually, I suppose, the big part of 2 months, constructing various facilities, including a radio and television studio for Mr. Armstrong at his home. And these are well underway. I don't know exactly when they'll be completed, but Mr. Armstrong is expecting and hoping to make 5 daily broadcasts weekly and also to make 1 telecast weekly. In case that you were worried about him and thought that he didn't have enough to do, maybe that will keep him busy. Everywhere we go, people ask us about Mr. Armstrong and his health. And I try to convey as best I can a little bit about his health, a little bit about his activities. Now, I presume all of you realize that he is very active. He doesn't believe in retirement. He's going on his 88th, he's in his 88th year. He's 87 years old and I guess a little more than a half now. And he's very, very active. It seems like just about every day that individuals or groups of individuals are visiting with him and taking to him various matters relating to various phases of the work. And I just mentioned now the activities of 2 days of this past week, Wednesday and Thursday. I don't know what he was doing yesterday or the other days of the week, but you can be sure that he was very busy during that particular time. But he is doing those things in addition to writing, and certainly he's doing more writing now than he has at any other time during his life. He also spends quite a bit of time on the telephone, people calling him from Pasadena in particular, and he calling them in Pasadena. He tries to get in a walk every day of about 1 to 3 miles. And he does this walking right around his pool. He has a small, and it's, I'd say, rather small swimming pool in his backyard. And so he goes around and around and around that pool. By now, I presume he knows the route from the many times he's gone around it. Now, because of his age and health and strength and so on, he's not able just to head out and go around there 3 miles straight. He has to walk a little way and then stop, and then walk a little way and then stop. But he has a little pedometer that tells him, you know, how many steps, and then that figures out the distance, and so he can tell from that about how far he, He has walked, but he usually tries to do from 1 to 3 miles a day, as I mentioned. He's also trying to be very careful about his diet, and I think that, not that he wasn't before, but I think that he's especially been concerned about that since his heart stoppage here a couple of years or so ago. The biggest problem, it seems like, from what I have observed, seems to be with his eyes, and also the problem of not sleeping at times, or not sleeping well at times. Now, you're aware, I'm sure, of his eye problems, at least in to an extent, and he has to use a magnifying lens to read a normal print Bible, and even a large print Bible he does, and all of the material that's normally sent over from Pasadena to him to read and to review the reports and so forth, articles and so on, are in large print, but even there he still has to use a magnifying glass part of the time. And I've not heard that his eyes are getting worse, nor have they been getting any better. Now, some months ago, he remarked that they were deteriorating a little bit, and he's not commented about that. So as far as I know, they have not gotten worse, but I'm quite sure they have not gotten better. You probably realize that he lost his sight in, I believe it's his right eye, some years ago. And this came about as a result of a detached retina. He can, I think, see light and dark, but as far as being able to have any vision, I don't think he has any vision at all in that particular eye. Then the left eye, I don't know what the percentage is, but seems to me I've heard 20 or 30% vision, something like that. And it's, you know, with difficulty that he does read particularly. The sleeping problem at times has been very disconcerting and upsetting to him. And I know at the feast he was having some difficulty along this line, and that's the reason why he did not appear on the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles, as had been scheduled at Tucson. But then, as a result of that and other things, of course, most or maybe all of you were able to see him, or at least hear him, the last day of the Feast of Tabernacles by either phone hookup or by a microwave hookup. And since he did not show at that particular time, the first day, then the rumors started going, and then there were some of those who are no longer with the Church of God, the Worldwide Church of God, who were announcing that Mr. Armstrong was dead or dying. And apparently even some of our people had heard those rumors. But I guess you all found out he was still alive on that last day of the feast. And I've had the privilege of visiting him, what is it, about 4 times, I think, since the Feast of Tabernacles, and every time I've been there, he's been alive. And I trust that he still is. Some people are quite worried about that. Others apparently are wishfully hoping that he would, and I hope that that doesn't include any of you. I hope that all of you are praying for him very diligently, that you're praying for him every day, that he will have a strong body, that he will have a strong mind, that he will have guidance and inspiration from God. And certainly he needs all of those things very, very much. So please continue to pray for him. And he needs a great deal of help from God, and also we need a great deal of help from him. When we were there Thursday, Mr. Armstrong mentioned that Mr. Rader was in Cairo preparing for Mr. Armstrong's trip in the spring. And I think that was mentioned in a recent a worldwide news article or a letter that he sent out. I'm not sure, maybe both. Then Mr. Rader is expecting to go on to Warsaw, hopefully to Moscow, and then to Peking, where he has a lecture scheduled before one of the universities there. He'll be gone, I think I heard, somewhere around 2 weeks on this particular trip. And he is hoping, of course, and Mr. Armstrong is hoping that they can continue with their plans to Moscow, but as a result of the recent invasion of Afghanistan, it's possible that that might have to be canceled. We just don't know. We'll have to wait and see, depending on the relations between the United States and USSR, that may or may not be possible. In case that they do, for example, stop the our participation in the Olympic Games in Moscow this next year, then that conceivably would also stop other travel, at least a lot of travel, to and from Moscow. So we'll just have to wait and see what God permits or what God wants to be done in that regard. Now, at the present time, and I think this week, there are about 45 ministerial transfers being announced. I won't announce any of them. I don't think that it's necessary to go through the long list. It will be published in due time, I'm sure, in the worldwide news. And this large number has come about as a result of the sabbatical program being changed, or maybe I should say being canceled, and probably you've heard something about that already, that the sabbatical program we've had some time where the ministers have been coming in for either one or two semesters at the college, that particular program has been canceled or stopped, and we have a totally different type of program. I don't know whether you'd call it sabbatical, but a different type of program for ministerial training. Now, the former program that we have had has required, of course, for 20, more or less 20 ministers and their families from the United States or around the world being uprooted from wherever they were, moving to Pasadena for, say, 9 months, 10 months, something like that, then moving again, making two moves, you see, within a year's time, back to a new assignment. And this by itself is rather traumatic, you know, just from the physical aspects of having to make two moves under those conditions under such a short time. And then in addition to that, during that year or that 9 months, it's almost a year when you consider the travel time going and coming, that the minister is not able to produce or not able to fulfill his normal duties as a minister. With the new program, of course, these ministers will be all assigned to the field, and then they will come in periodically once a year or once every 2 years or 3 years, depending on circumstances. Usually about a group of 30 ministers will come in and be there for 3 weeks, being gone from their local pastorates 2 Sabbaths. And then during that time, they will have very intense instruction and training and activities on campus. They'll be staying on campus, and they will, they'll be housed right on campus, that is, having their meals there and their classes and so on. So it'll be a rather concentrated 3 week period where they'll be having this particular training and instruction. Well, since the old program has been discontinued, that means that approximately 20 sabbatical ministers are being assigned to the field. And in case you're worried, we don't have any transfers planned for the St. Louis area, so you don't need to expect now another change of the several changes you've had in the last year or so here. And I don't recall of any changes nearby, the nearby churches. I think the nearest might be in Memphis, or I think we're changing the pastorate there. Then there is a change in Chicago. I think we're sending a man there as associate pastor. I don't think anyone's leaving there. And those are the nearby areas that come to mind. Oh, I think we're sending a man also to Columbus, Ohio, which is quite some distance from here. And otherwise, I don't recall of any close by. Now, I might comment a little bit about the legal situation. I'm sure that all of you are anxious for this legal situation in California to be resolved, and I'm sure that you're not more anxious than those in Pasadena and those that are particularly involved in this. But things are still moving along slowly. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes activities by the state and also the church attorneys. And I can't report anything new particularly relating to that. I think in order to understand that case fully, you have to be an attorney and you have to be working full-time involved in it, because it's a rather sophisticated, very complicated thing. I presume all of you realize that the state did take over the legal control of the church for a period of time, and would probably like to do so again if they could. But, of course, we're trying to resist that with every legal means that we can, so that that does not happen again, so that they are not able to do that. Now, I thought I would read in part an article from another publication that's not associated with the Church of God that describes some of the things that have been taking place in that particular suit. And this particular article appeared in the September-October of Liberty Magazine. That's September-October of 1979. And the article is on page 22. This particular publication is either a publication by or associated with, I'm not sure which, the Seventh-day Adventist Church. So it's, as I said, not one of our publications, but by another church that does not believe as we do. They believe maybe as we do on one or two points, but otherwise, it's quite different from our beliefs. But anyway, this article was written by Jerry Wiley, who is Associate Dean, University of Southern California Law Center, Los Angeles, California. The title of the article, The Incredible Becomes Bizarre, and it's a continuing look at developments in the case of California versus the Worldwide Church of God. They also make reference here to a previous article in the May-June issue of their magazine on page 2, which was called A Constitutional Outrage. When the California Attorney General and six disfellowshipped members of the Worldwide Church of God persuaded the Superior Court to take over the church's operations on January 3, 1979, because of alleged irregularities in the expenditure of church funds, the case seemed incredible. However, some of the events that have happened since must be characterized as bizarre. For example, during that portion of the lawsuit known as discovery, the Deputy Attorney General attempted to question a church official concerning the contents of a certain document. A review of the document revealed that it was an accounting of the church's income and expenditures for the past 20 years. What was so startling about this document was that, one, its contents were precisely what the Attorney General and the dissident church members had claimed had never been prepared. I think they had the idea that we just didn't make any financial statements and that the money came and went and nobody knew where it went or how it was spent. Actually, of course, every penny was accounted for. And number two, it had never been released to the public. How then did the Attorney General's office get it? And when asked that question by the attorneys for the church, the state attorney refused to answer. My opinion is the reason why they refused to answer is because they had obtained it illegally. They'd either stolen it from us or they had gotten it from somebody else who had stolen it from us. In another bizarre development, the six dissidents have withdrawn from the case. I think actually that the Attorney General saw that it was to the advantage of the state that they no longer be a party to it, thus leaving the Attorney General himself a little in doubt about who's doing what to whom. The Worldwide Church of God is trying to serve requests for admissions on the six, in other words, to force them to produce evidence on which their charges were based or to admit that they had none. Now I'd like to skip on. Liberty leaders... No, let me read another paragraph here. The Office of the Attorney General of California is involved in other strange proceedings, some against churches and some against lawyers. And I might say that there's an increasing hue and cry in the news media in California concerning the present Attorney General, George Dukmejian. And it seems like that many think that he is taking great liberties and going above and beyond what he should be doing in that particular office. And some have said that he has more power in the state of California than the governor. You all know Jerry Brown, I'm sure, or know of him. Well, he's the governor, and they say that Dukmejian has more power than Jerry Brown has. But he has really been stirring up a lot of trouble because of his involvement in many of the departments in the state, let alone other matters of the state. Well, let's see, these other strange proceedings, some against churches and some against lawyers. The Morningland Church case is an example of both. Recently, the Attorney General's office claimed to have heard from a dissident member that the church, a 1,000-member congregation in Long Beach, California, had made a political contribution which would be in a violation of the law. The Attorney General, George Dukmejian, had warrants issued and deputies made arrests in church during church services. They seized certain documents and raided the offices of the church's attorney, going through files of the attorney's clients, most of whom had nothing to do with the church under investigation. The position of the California Attorney General seems to be that if you are a client represented by an attorney who happens to represent a person or organization under investigation, your rights of privacy and your attorney-client privileges are swept aside for the greater good of the state. The Attorney General recently invaded the offices of a major Los Angeles law firm in a sweeping investigation, much like the Morningland Church investigation. Deputies began going through not only clients' files, but also some things that in no way could be called files. This reminds me that when they invaded the Worldwide Church of God, they took files, you know, copies of letters, correspondence, memoranda, and so on from the executive offices, Mr. Armstrong's offices, Mr. Rader's offices, and others. Away in boxes, you know, you'll see this in this documentary if you have a chance to see it later on. And even they admitted before the court that they had almost 1,000 separate documents that they had taken and had in their possession that they had to enumerate and list as to what they were. And some have estimated they may have as many as 100,000 different sheets of paper that they have taken or confiscated or copied of our files. The law firm got a restraining order from the Los Angeles Superior Court with Judge Jerry Pacht. You may have heard of him before. Judge Jerry Pacht angrily decrying the behavior of the Attorney General's office. The rebuke is another bizarre note in California judicial conduct, for it was Judge Pacht who issued the original order against the Worldwide Church of God. Is Judge Pacht's position that the attorney-client privilege provides more protection in our nation than the First Amendment? You see, we believe that everything he has done so far against the Worldwide Church of God is contrary to the First Amendment, which, of course, he says is not so. We say it is. Liberty readers will recall that the six dissident church members who precipitated the case against the Worldwide Church of God were represented by private attorneys Raphael and Hillel Chodos. Now the Chodoses claim that the church should have to pay their fees for attacking it, fees that exceed $175,000 for about 2 months of work. I'm going to skip over some of this and come now to another paragraph. As of this writing, the church has posted a bond of $1 million to regain possession of its property from the state. Although the state was required to post only a $10,000 bond. Now here was a man, Judge Stephen Wiseman, who was appointed as receiver. He was a man of a different religious faith, probably knew very little about the Worldwide Church of God or our beliefs or how we carried on our business or whatever. And when he came in and had really more legal power than Mr. Herbert Armstrong has ever had, he only had to post a $10,000 bond. But now when it's turned back to the church officials, we have to post a $1 million bond. Now why? Well, I guess from their point of view, and based on what they have said in court, and of course this is a record in the legal transcripts of the court case, we do not own the assets and the income of the Worldwide Church of God. All of that belongs to the good people of the state of California. And I'm not joking, that's exactly what they have said in court time after time after time. And you see, they are trying to protect the good people of the state of California from these allegations. So we had to post a $1 million bond. They had to post a $10,000 bond. The bond was raised when 1,000 church members, this was in California, pledged their personal assets. If the California Attorney General has his way, members of any church incorporated in and perhaps having any contacts with California may be making donations to the state, with the church simply acting as a depository until the state can intervene to collect the money. What is the state's defense in its actions in the Worldwide Church of God case? Their basic legal position is that if the state suspects that the church is not spending the money it collects from its members properly, and that's put in quotes, the state, acting through the court, may come in and take ownership of all funds and real and personal property of the church and do with them as the state sees fit. Now, do you think that we would ever, in 1,000 years, be able to convince the officials of the state of California that we spend the money the way it ought to be spent? Do you think that they would agree and approve Mr. Armstrong's trips overseas to various international or national figures, leaders, heads of government, and so on? They ask it even in court, you know, well, how many converts did you get? You see, to them, that's what the purpose of all of this should be, for converts. Well, we all know that that's not even the purpose. It's just to, preach the gospel as a witness. And, of course, they don't know what the gospel is. I think they would probably disagree with our definition of what the gospel is or what we're doing. The church, according to this viewpoint, merely holds the funds and property for the benefit of all the people of the state, even though most of the money is collected from members who live outside California. Further, the Attorney General contends that the church may not use these funds to defend itself from the state because the money now belongs not to the church, but to the state. Of course, the church may use these funds to pay its attackers. Well, this is a very factual article, I might say, by the way, based on the court transcripts. You know, it's just not an interpretation or someone's idea. I hope that will give you a little different view of what has been going on in the state of California with this massive assault and persecution against the Church of God. Now, I know some people, some of the detractors, some of the accusers would have a different story than that, but when you read the court transcripts, you can see that what I just read to you is a rather accurate appraisal of what has been said and what's going on there. So maybe that'll give you a fresh view from somebody else's point of view of what's been going on there, and hope that you're continually praying that God will resolve this in the way that He wants. And, of course, good is coming from it, and will continue to come from it, and whatever God has in mind will work out in the long run, but we need to be praying about it, very concerned about it, because it affects all of us. Well, that's all I'll have now. That's the sermonette for this morning. Usually a sermonette's supposed to be about 12, 14 minutes, and I spoke for about 42 minutes, so please excuse me for that, and I hope the man who gives the sermon won't mind. The suspense gave me time enough to get my Bible. My wife and I were called into the church and started attending in 1951. And I think that in 1951, when I went to the Feast of Tabernacles, at least for part of the time, I think it was a weekend, in Belknap Springs, we had one person who was here in this audience. Might have been more than one. Is there any more than one who would have been at the Feast in 1951? Would you raise your hands? I can't even see the one. Oh, there's the one back there. Anybody else? Well, at least two of us were at the Feast in Belknap Springs in 1951. So we've been in a church now a little over 28 years. And over that particular period of time, we have found that most of our closest friends that my wife and I have had, I don't mean all of our friends, but most of our closest friends during that time are no longer with us. Now, I know that some of you have lost dear friends in recent months or recent years also from the Church of God. Now, these people left the Church of God, and when each left, certainly was a very sad and a very upsetting experience for all of us. Now, why is it that they left? Why did they leave? But more importantly, how can we avoid making the same mistakes that they made? One, that we should run with patience the race that is set before us. Now, in the race that we are in, we are not in it just so that one could receive the prize, as I mentioned, but all who complete the race receive the prize. And that prize, of course, is eternal life. Now, when you think about that, you might think of the Boston Marathon or various other marathons, but that one comes to mind. It's about the most famous marathon race, I think, in the United States. There are some others, I guess, that are quite famous abroad as well. But if you were going to enter the Boston Marathon, would you be entering that race to be the first one across the finish line? If you were entering that race, probably you'd realize that you would not be able to be the first one across the finish line. It seems like it's a rather select few who have crossed that finish line first, I guess. And in recent years, I think one man has won it a couple times, or maybe more than that. And the object of entering, at least I would think for most, is not, well, I want to be first, but rather I want to finish. That is the goal. You see, the goal is the finish line, whether it takes X number of hours or X number of hours plus. And when you watch this on television, and it seems like each year they have a little blurb on television about the Boston Marathon, and they will show you the field of runners as they start out. And it seems to me that the last one was maybe 5,000 people, more or less, who entered that particular race. Now, all 5,000 didn't think they were going to be first. You can be sure of that. What they were trying to do, as I said, was to finish. Maybe they were trying to better their own time, their previous time, but I'm sure that most of them realized, you know, well, I can't be number one. There were probably just a very few of those who had hoped and maybe expected that they would be number one. Then when you see the end of the race on television, you see the man who comes across first. But probably you won't see the man who was second or third or fourth or whatever. Then they'll probably show you the first woman who completed the race. And then maybe they'll show you a fellow who was in a wheelchair or who had some physical disability and how he was able to complete that particular race. And that's all you see. You know, you don't see the second, third, fourth winners. You just see the first and then those others. Well, making it into God's kingdom and completing the spiritual race is a little bit like that. Our goal is not to be number one. The goal is to complete the race. Back quite a number of years ago, in fact, almost 17 years ago, on Thursday, May 16th, 1963, in Pasadena, California, the college had its annual field day. And on an annual field day, there are all kinds of athletic events going on all day long. And sometimes there's more than one activity at the same time. Maybe some will be playing tennis, others will be playing some other game, others will be running or jumping or pole vaulting or whatever it might be. And a lot of the faculty and a lot of the friends and so forth would be in the bleachers watching these various events, and in particular the running events. And on that particular occasion, there was a race of girls, the 880-yard race, or run, I guess they call it, 880-yard run for the girls. At that time, we had an eighth of a mile track. Presently, we have a nicer, longer track, a quarter-mile track, but I think it was an eighth of a mile. It might have been a sixth of a mile, but I think it was an eighth of a mile. And I may be, it surely was one or the other. And I can remember as the girls started out, there was one young girl who was ahead of everyone else. She, you might say, led the pack. And she went around several laps. I think it might have been three laps if it were an eighth of a mile track. And I guess I should check and make sure one way or the other what size track that was. But anyway, she was way out ahead until about the last lap. And then at the last lap, the others began to pass her. And pretty soon they all passed her, and she was now in the rear, way behind the others, and just going very slowly compared to the way they had been going. And I watched her, and as the others were going past the finish line, you know, the first, second, third, and so on, I noticed her on the other side of the track, and she just stopped running, and she walked off the track and off, I think, behind some buildings, and I guess that was the last I saw her that particular day. This particular girl quit. She left the field. She was a quitter. You know, she never completed that race to this day. And I would like to ask now, are you a quitter? Some of my friends have been quitters. They quit. Or to put it in different ways, they gave up the ship. Now, when I think about that, of giving up the ship in that particular analogy, I'm reminded of a story that Dale Hanway, who was one of our older married students who came to Ambassador College back in the early 60s, I think, that he told us in an ambassador club one time. And Mr. Hanway was in the war, World War II, and I think he was a co-pilot on a B-17 bomber stationed in England, the particular occasion that I'm going to refer to here. And they were bombing various parts of Europe. And at times, of course, especially at the early part of the bombings, they were really getting a lot of flak, not, you know, the verbal kind, but the literal flak, anti-aircraft guns, in other words, and shells, trying to shoot them down. And they had been over their target, had been, well, not he, but someone else, another man that he knew, that he met in another B-17, and they had been shot up very, very badly at the target area, and things were very grim. It was a little bit doubtful at the time whether they would ever make it back to base because they had received such severe damage to the airplane. A very serious situation, a critical situation. And as a result of this, as they limped back towards home, there was confusion, there was terror on board. The captain told the crew by intercom, he says, "Now be ready to jump." And one of the gunners in the rear then was sitting by the bomb bay. The bomb bay was open and waiting there for the captain's order to jump. And the plane began to shudder and shake, and I don't know what else. I guess they got some turbulent air or whatever. And he thought, well, this is it, so he jumped. Now, the captain hadn't told him to jump. He had said, be ready to jump, but he hadn't told them to jump yet. So he jumped. Well, now, just before he jumped, of course, things were chaotic and in confusion. And now, all of a sudden, as he jumped and the parachute opened, things were very peaceful and very quiet. And quite a change, you know, after being in the chaos and the trouble that he was in that crippled airplane. And he watched the airplane and, you know, sort of expected it was going to crash, but it didn't. It just kept going right on, and finally it went out of sight as he floated down to Earth. Well, when he landed, he was captured, and he spent the remainder of the war as a prisoner of war of the Germans. Sometime after this, there were others who, from his particular wing, that also were captured, and so he asked them, you know, did my plane make it back to base? Yes, it did. And so this man, he jumped ship. You know, he quit. He gave up ship because things were chaotic and in great trouble, and he had peace and quiet for a little while. But he spent the rest of the war as a prisoner of war. Now, some of those who have left God's church, they jumped ship at a time when maybe there was a lot of confusion and a lot of chaos and upset conditions and uncertain things. And maybe they were hearing all kinds of bad rumors, and they didn't know whether they were true or not true, or maybe they thought they were true. And so they jumped ship. And to carry on the analogy, I think you'll find that those people are going to be a prisoner of war, but a different kind of a prisoner of war for the duration. Now, we must not follow their example, those that have jumped ship, those who have stopped from the race, those who have left the race. You probably remember the statement by Paul in Philippians 3, verse 14, where he says in part, I press towards the mark of the high calling in Christ Jesus, or for the prize of the high calling of God in Christ Jesus. Now that's what we need to be doing. You know, we need to be pressing with all of our energy towards that mark, towards that goal, towards that tape, towards that string at the end of the race, towards the resurrection and to eternal life, and not let anything deter us from completing that race. Now, we're all in that race, but do you realize that we all run at a little different speed? Some of us maybe are sprinters, some of us maybe are runners, and some of us maybe are plodders. The speed is not the important thing, necessarily. What is important, that we never stop, that we continue on, no matter what happens, until we complete the race. Now, it seems rather unusual, but in our immediate family, our elder son, Larry, who is the pastor of the church in Tucson, in his college days, in his high school days, did very well as a runner. In fact, he usually, I think, always won the 1 and 2 mile run in high school, and then often did in college. I think that until Mr. Ernest Williams came along and bettered him, he pretty well always won those particular races. And I can still remember the first time that I saw him run when he was, about in his middle years of high school. Some of the teachers had been telling me, you know, have you seen your son run? Or they'd be talking about how well he ran. And I'd never seen him run. I was not a runner. I wasn't interested particularly in that type of thing. But we went to a high school field day one time, and I saw my son run for the first time. He ran in, the 1 mile that particular day, probably the 2 miles as well. And I was just shocked to see how gracefully he ran. Now, I also noticed that there were some others who seemed to run with great difficulty and were rather awkward in the way they ran. I suppose they were working harder at it than he was, as far as that's concerned. But it seemed like it was just a natural thing with him. And I was so impressed by it. Well, then, some years later, his younger brother came along in high school, and he didn't like the mile run or the 2 mile run. I don't think he ever entered in those. But he was a sprinter, and he would enter the various dashes, you know, the 100-yard dash or whatever, and he did very well. I don't remember whether he won or not. Seems to me he may have sometimes, but he did very well. That was his strength. I don't know where they got these running abilities. I don't think they got them from me, because I never was a runner, even when I was in high school. Even when I was young, that was the last thing in the world I wanted to do, was to run. But I've always been a plodder. You know, a plodder is one who walks. I enjoy walking. And so I think of myself as a plodder. And I mention this because I presume that probably some of you might feel the same way about yourself. You know, you're not the flashy sprinter or runner that everybody's watching. Maybe you're just the tortoise. You know, you just keep going and going and going and going, and you never stop. You've all heard, of course, the child story of the hare and the tortoise, the race they had, and you know who won. It was the tortoise who won. At least the story says that way. Probably such a thing never happened. But some of us are like that. You know, we're just plodders. Now, I have seen over the years others who came in the church after I came in the church. They had great abilities, great intellect, charisma maybe, personality, and so on, at Ambassador College and also in the ministry and in the church. And it seemed like they just went by me like I was standing still, but they're not in the race anymore. At least most of them aren't in the race anymore. And I've just been plodding right along, and I'm determined. And I hope you are too, because whether you are a plodder or whether you're a runner, the important thing is not how fast you're running, but that you keep going. Maybe even you need to be a little stubborn about it, you know, and you just sort of set your jaw and your mind is on that goal, and I'm going to make it, as they say, come hell or high water. We need to keep at it, keep up, don't quit, and be determined. Now, I don't know what happened with some of those who raced by so quickly. Maybe they came to a cliff and they were going so fast they couldn't stop. Or maybe they found some side road along the line and they took that and they went the wrong direction. I don't know what's happened to some of them. I guess God only knows, and that's His responsibility, not mine. But anyway, some of them are gone. Some of the sprinters, some of the runners, some of them didn't last very long. And sadly, too many of them are gone. Now, whether you're a sprinter or a runner or a plodder, the main thing is we need to keep our eye on the goal, the kingdom of God. And when we look at that and see how great that is and how important that is, nothing else matters very much. The only thing that matters is to finish the race. Now, why have some quit? Why have some turned aside? There are many reasons, I'm sure, and maybe each case is a little different than every other. Probably as different as people are different. But here are some of the reasons, six of them, that I want to mention that I have noted over the years of those that I knew personally, some of them very, very well, and happening to know some of the specifics in their case as to what happened. Now, the first one I'd like to mention is that I've observed for some that finally their sins caught up with them. Now, they may have had private, secret sins, and in some cases maybe they weren't so private or maybe not so secret, but they did have sins that they did not overcome or that they did not put out of their lives. I'll give you some examples. The first one that I knew about, a real close friend we had in Portland, Oregon, where we first came in the church back in 1951, and I think it was in the late 50s that a couple of our closest friends left the church. But just before that, a little while before that, we found that they had stopped tithing. Now, I don't know why they stopped tithing, because they had been tithing at one time, and they stopped. And, of course, if you don't tithe, you are stealing from God. So you're breaking several of the laws of God as far as that's concerned. And sooner or later, someone like that, who is stealing from God, who is not doing what God says in that particular aspect of life, sooner or later, they're going to find that the grass is greener somewhere else. They're going to find cause to become offended or whatever, and they will no longer be with us. In some other cases, I've known of some who were breaking the Sabbath. They had sort of watered down the teachings of the church, and after a while, the Sabbath for them was just about like any other day. Maybe now they were sort of keeping their Sunday on Saturday. Maybe you've heard some speak of us in that way. Well, we don't keep the Sabbath like other people keep Sunday, by any means. Or at least we hadn't ought to be. So some of them began to be careless about how they kept the Sabbath until it was almost like every other day of the week, except maybe they went to services on the Sabbath, and sometimes they didn't even do that. I have known of some who were former ministers of the church who are now no longer in God's church, you know, who they would not think anything about taking off on the Sabbath to go up in the mountain skiing instead of attending Sabbath service, or going to the beach instead of attending Sabbath service, or in some cases even on holy days. Instead of going to services, they would maybe stay home and relax and go swimming in the pool and the apartment or the house, whatever it might be, and sun themselves and so on. And, you know, it doesn't take very long to do things like that until you're no longer in God's church. I've known of others who drank too much. And in due time, that caught up with them. Others who committed or were committing adultery, either one occasion or repeated, and apparently not repented of. Other occasions, I think of one specific case of a man who had a very responsible position in God's church, and he misappropriated some of the funds of the church and used it for a personal purpose. Well, he was doing fine for a little while, and bang, all of a sudden he was gone. He's not been back since. So that was what happened to some that I know of. Their personal sins caught up with them. Now, God will put up with sin maybe a little while. But the time comes, you know, he comes back and comes back, and we're still living the same old way. And he'll say, you know, cut the tree down, and that's the end. Now, a second thing that I've noticed was that some of them disagreed with church doctrines. A few years before that time, they supposedly heard those doctrines, supposedly proved those doctrines, and apparently joyfully received them, believing that, you know, this is God's church, this is the truth. And then a few years later, they determined or decided, whatever it was, you know, well, those doctrines are all wrong. How sad, how strange. The third reason, some became upset over real or imagined injustices in the church or in the work. And maybe they thought, you know, so-and-so didn't get a good deal. They got a raw deal. Or maybe they thought that happened to them. And I think that things happen to all of us at one time or another, maybe several times, where we could conclude that and say, you know, well, I got a raw deal. They shouldn't have done this, or they shouldn't have done that. And maybe it was a real fault or a real problem, or maybe it wasn't. But whether it was real or imagined, because of these so-called or apparent injustices, then they left the church. The fourth thing that I have noticed, some became offended over the leadership of the church. And usually it was not directly Mr. Armstrong. It was usually someone maybe close to him. But indirectly it was Mr. Armstrong, and sometimes it was him directly. They disagreed about how the church was being run. And some of them said, well, we should not have this hierarchical type of church government, that we should have a committee. And, of course, you can guess who they thought ought to be on the committee. At least one should be on the committee. That would be number one. And they didn't like, you know, maybe various policies that were established or whatever by the leadership of the church. And so they left. Others became upset over what other people did or didn't do. And in some cases, especially some of those who have prominent positions in the work, it doesn't matter whether they do something or don't do it. It'll be taken wrong by some people. And as the old saying goes, you know, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. And that's the way it is for some people. You know, they just can't do anything right. And so for that reason, some have left. Then, the sixth reason that I've noticed is that some were not content to wait for what they thought were needed changes. And sometimes these needed changes that they thought needed to be done really didn't need to be done. And in other cases, maybe they needed to be. I think of particularly a couple church doctrines that were changed, one relating to Pentecost, one relating to divorce and remarriage, and the last one, of course, being misunderstood by a lot of people and misapplied. But some were not content to wait for needed changes. They wanted to make those changes. They forgot, apparently, or rejected the fact that Jesus Christ is the head of the church, and that all power had been given to him in heaven and on earth, and that he could and that he would correct any problems in the church in his own time, in his own way. But they were not content to wait for that. And as I mentioned, in some cases, they left because they believed that Pentecost should be on Sunday. Well, they were right in their conclusion, and usually they were wrong in how they came to that conclusion. At least I don't know of anybody who came to it from the right premise. and others in regard to divorce and remarriage. Now, if they could have just waited a little while, even a few months, that would have been changed. But they were not content to wait on the head of the church, Jesus Christ. Really, when it gets right down to it, I don't think they believed that Jesus Christ was the head of the church. They were looking to some man, and when that man didn't do the way they thought he ought to do, then they were disenchanted and they left. Now, in these cases, what these people really did was to reject God's government. They rebelled. And you'll find over in the book of Samuel, 1 Samuel, that rebellion is as a sin of witchcraft, which is a pretty serious sin, I would think. And you can read 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, where a similar thing happened, where people rejected God's government and what God said about it. Now, they thought they were just disagreeing with how Samuel ran things, more particularly what his sons did or didn't do. Now, in thinking of these various reasons why people have left the church that I have personally known about, I was reminded of one of the parables, one of the very well-known parables, the parable of the sower. I'm not going to turn there because I would think that it would be very familiar to all of you. You'll find it in three places in the scriptures, Matthew 13, Mark 4, and Luke 8. But in going through all of those particular accounts, I noticed that there were seven specific reasons why some did not continue. You remember the story how that the sower went out to sow, and he sowed seed. Some of it fell on stony places, some of it fell in thorny places, some of it fell on good ground, and so on. So I noticed that there was seven different reasons that were mentioned there as to why some did not continue. Some of them went just a little while, some went a little longer, but none of them, except for the last group, you know, that bore good fruit, some 30, some 100, some 60, some 100-fold, I think it says, except for those, the others, somewhere along the line, stopped and did not continue. I would like just to reiterate these particular reasons. One was affliction. And I would assume affliction might include different things. It could include illness, could include financial reverses, problems of one kind or another. And some have come up against problems, illness, affliction, whatever, and that has been the end of them. And probably you have known some like that as well. The second reason that is mentioned is persecution. Now, when the church was persecuted in California with this takeover. Now, some laugh at that and scoff at it and say, well, that's not persecution. Well, maybe it isn't to them, but it sure is to me. And I think it is to most of God's people as far as that's concerned. But as a result of what happened there, some lost faith and left the church. And the persecution is going to get worse as far as that's concerned. I think the persecution there is just a little different than people anticipated. The third reason that's mentioned is temptation. And some were tempted. I mentioned, for example, some who were stealing tithes. Others who were committing adultery. Others who were breaking the Sabbath. And I presume that that came about as a result of temptation somewhere along the line, and they just were weak enough that they did whatever it was that they were tempted to do. And, of course, this is a temptation that usually comes as a result of Satan and his devices, where he works on our own lust. And in their particular case, they weakened and they were tempted and they sinned. The fourth reason that is mentioned in those particular, in that particular parable is a deceitfulness of riches. You know, many people, I suppose most people today in the United States, are having difficulty making ends meet. Not all, but I suppose the overwhelming majority are having that problem because it seems like the American public usually wants to live beyond its income. And people look around and they see what money will buy, and you know they would like to have that money so they could enjoy these things. Things look alluring. And I think, for example, some ministers who were no longer with us. And they looked around and they saw other men making more money than they. And so then they began to think about that. Some of them began to prepare for that for the future, to try to get maybe proper training so that they could in due time leave the ministry and so that they could make more money. I'm reminded of a true story that one of our ministers, Jerry Whitty, told me some years ago. Jerry Whitty is the pastor of, I think it's a Sherman, Texas church. And back in 1974, there was a group of ministers who were in the process of breaking away, and did break away, and formed their own church. And they were working on Jerry Whitty. They'd gone to school with him, and they knew him, and some of them particularly. They'd been classmates together, and so one, I won't mention his name, he's no longer with us, of course, but he says, Jerry, he says, come with you. He says, you'll make more money with us than you ever will with the Worldwide Church of God and Herbert Armstrong. Well, Jerry didn't go. He stayed with the church. He's still, as I said, a minister in the church. But what happened to the man who tried to get him to leave? Well, it wasn't very long until he found out that those people that went with them were not going to support him in the style that he expected, and he had to go out and get a job somewhere. So maybe he was deceived by all of these riches that he was going to make, but he found out that he wasn't going to get them that way. Now, along with that, I might just mention an aside here in regard to this. This particular group of ministers, they disagreed on several doctrines, but one doctrine related to tithing. And they had come to the conclusion that tithing was not a law, it was just a principle. And since it's a principle, I guess you can sort of either take it or leave it however you want. And if you want to tithe, I guess it's all right, there's no law against it, but you don't have to. And so, you know, you can give whatever offering you want, or if you don't want to, I guess you don't have to do that. Or you can give 5% or 1%. You know, that's entirely up to you. Now, let me give you some advice, if any of you are ministers here. And, of course, we have a couple ministers, and I'm saying this tongue-in-cheek, I hope you realize. But if you're a minister, and you're going to try to take some of the people of the Church of God away, and start your own church, and expect them to support you royally, don't teach that tithing is just a principle. Because if you do, you'll just cut your own throat. Now, I say that facetiously, but I also say it seriously because. And the reason why I say that is because it's a law. You know, and it's thus saith the Eternal. That's the main reason, you know, not just because you're going to cut your own throat. Anyway, that's what those fellows found. And that particular movement, which took away, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 people from the Church of God in the United States. The last I heard, there was one man who still had a small congregation. All the rest of them are gone. And I don't know what they're all doing, but they're not living off that particular church any longer. All right, so the deceitfulness of riches, apparently in those particular cases, caused those men to leave the Church of God. The fifth reason that is mentioned is the worries of the world, the cares of this life, making a living, making ends meet, providing for the self and for the family in the style that we think we should be having. Now, this can be a great concern, and where the Bible warns us against this being something we're overly concerned about, he says, you know, not to take any anxious thought about these things. Put the kingdom of God first, and these things are going to be taken care of. But some begin to worry about these things. They begin to put their mind and their thoughts on these things rather than on the things of God. Now, the sixth reason that is mentioned is the pleasures of this life. Now, everyone wants happiness. Everyone wants pleasure. None of us wants pain and unhappiness and woe and trouble. But to some of us, the world appears rather attractive. We see affluence around us, at least that some seem to have. We see that some people have more of the things of this life than we have. We see maybe the thrills that other people are receiving from recreation or from success or from sex or whatever reason, and you know, we want to have that. Or maybe we're having some of these things and we want to have more of them. We want to continue to happen, to have them. So there are many pleasures of this life that people seek after. And in the time that we live today, we live in a time of the greatest danger, I believe, and the greatest hazard of all time. And when you see what's happening in the world, what's happening in Afghanistan, what's happening in Iran, and other parts of the globe, certainly there is the greatest threat to peace and happiness and security now that there ever has been. And especially when we know what the Bible says about these things, we are very aware of that. And the time of the greatest hazard, the greatest danger in the world, is a time when it seems like more people, even in the Church of God, are concerned about the pleasures of this life. And they want to hang on a little bit. You know, it's, I want to have mine while the getting's good. I want to hang on to it as long as I can. That's the sixth reason. And the seventh reason is the desire of other things. And I guess there's no end to that, is there? Other things. But that's sort of a catch-all for anything that's been left out. The desire of other things, whatever they may be. And, of course, when we have the desire of other things, we want to have the pleasures of this life and these various other things, we neglect the things of God. Now, some people want their reward now. They're not content to wait for God to give it to them at the resurrection. They want it now, and that becomes a big thing in their life. And then they're no longer a part of God's church. Well, these are the reasons why some people have left God's church. And I hope none of us are headed in that particular direction. But I hope that all of us have as our greatest goal, the uppermost thing in our mind, the desire, the earnest desire, whatever the cost, that we are going to receive that goal. We're going to reach that goal. We're going to receive our part in God's kingdom, in spite of the tribulations, the trials, the tests, the problems. Now, there are three main points that I would like to mention first before we get into some specific things, but these are just general things here. In order to reach that goal, first we need to recognize what that goal is, the kingdom of God, and believe and be convinced that it's more important to attain that goal than any or all other goals or all other things. That is the most desirable thing for us, is to reach that goal, the kingdom of God. Secondly, to determine that we are going to reach that goal no matter what. To set our will. Maybe even be a little stubborn, you know, and just, this is what I'm going to do and nothing's going to stop me. I'm reminded of this old saying in connection with this. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift accomplishment of their appointed routes. I suppose you've heard that before. You thought, well, that's talking about the U.S. Postal Service. Maybe it's not too applicable anymore, but maybe it was at one time. And that's sort of the attitude we need to have. You know, I'm going to complete this race no matter what happens. You know, it doesn't matter about the weather or difficulties of any or every kind. Now, that old saying, maybe you thought that it was written about the U.S. Postal Service. You might be interested to notice that it was not. It was written a little bit before the United States Postal Service was established. It was written in 430 B.C. by a famous historian, Herodotus, in his histories. And he was talking about the Persian post riders. He wasn't talking about the U.S. Mail Service. But I thought it was rather an appropriate thing, you know. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift accomplishment of their appointed routes. That's sort of the attitude we need to have. You know, I'm going to complete the route no matter what happens. Don't let anything deter you from your goal. Whether you're a sprinter, whether you're a runner, or whether you're just a plodder like me, the important thing is to keep it up and never stop. Now let's turn to the book of Matthew in chapter 24. To notice here a little bit what's going on, what is happening, and what we must do if we're going to reach that goal. Matthew 24, verse 9. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted. He's talking here in a dual sense to national Israel, all 12 tribes, and also he's talking about the church. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted, or to tribulation. That's the same word you'll find in verse 21, where it speaks about great tribulation. And shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And we're seeing that fulfilled in such places as Iran right now. And then shall many be offended. You know, we have seen some, haven't we, have been offended. Offended at the church, offended at the brethren, offended at the leadership of the church, and shall betray one another. And in some cases we have had former brethren betray God's church, make accusations that were untrue, and shall hate one another. And isn't it sad when someone who, you know, in years past had great love and affection, a kindly person, to turn around now and just be filled with hate and venom almost like a snake, and just rant and rail literally about God's people or the leadership in the church. And many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. And there have been a few in God's church, some who apparently started out right, but somewhere along the way they turned another direction. And they have deceived some in the church of God and led them away. And because iniquity or lawlessness, it could be better translated, shall abound, and the world, you know, is just increasing and abounding in lawlessness and sin. And now you might say the status quo and the way people act and what people do would not have been thought of maybe a few decades ago. What is accepted now would have been the bizarre, the peculiar, the odd, the unknown, the unspeakable of a few decades ago. He says, the love of many shall wax or grow cold. And that's what's happened to some of these that I've been talking about. They had love to start with, but it grew cold. But he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. Now that analogy, of course, is a little different, but it's the same principle as I've been talking about. It's the one who completes the race, the one who endures to the end, not the one who stops along the way. If we stop along the way for whatever reason, whatever good we may have done, God says doesn't amount to anything anymore. It's just as though it never had happened. So that's what we need to do. We need to endure to the end. But now I want to go to some more specific ways is how we can endure to the end, how we can complete the race, and how that we can be sure that we will not fall. I'd like to turn to 2 Peter chapter 1. 2 Peter chapter 1. This particular passage gives us certain instructions of certain things that we should do. And I would like to point out, at the end of verse 10, he says, if you do these things, you shall never fall. Now that's what I want to emphasize today, how you can keep from falling, because this section of the scriptures tell us how we can be sure that we will not fall. Let's go back and notice at the beginning of the chapter. This is, of course, by Simon Peter. And he talks about the precious faith that we have obtained, the faith of Jesus Christ. And he mentions about the divine power that God has given us. Verse 3. According as his divine power has given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness through the knowledge of him that has called us to glory and virtue, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises. Now, what are those promises? Those promises, we might say, include the kingdom of God, or it is the kingdom of God. That by these promises you might be partakers of the divine nature,